The Chocolate Money Mystery by Alexander McCall Smith. Opening announcement. This book was published in 2006 by Bloomsbury, London. It was recorded for the Royal New Zealand Foundation of the Blind in 2006, narrated by Michelle Hine, and produced by Helen Marney. Sponsorship. The recording of this book is generously sponsored by the School Dental Foundation. Indexing. Cassette copies of this book are tone indexed at each heading as indicated in the contents list. Daisy versions have one level. Contents. Book notes. More great titles by Alexander McCall Smith. Chapter 1. Max and Maddie, Private Detectives. Page 5. Chapter 2. Wanted for Bank Robbery. Page 15. Chapter 3. St. Bernard Dog Seeks Home. Page 25. Chapter 4. A Familiar Face. Page 36. Chapter 5. The Trapdoor. Page 45. Chapter 6. Cable Car Adventure. Page 59. Chapter 7. Chocolate Money. Page 72. Closing announcement. Page 81. Book notes. From the author of the best-selling number one ladies detective agency series. Mr. Hufendorf fished into the inner pocket of his jacket and took out a small folded poster. On the top, printed in very large letters, it said, "Wanted for Bank Robbery." He handed the poster over to the children, who studied it carefully. "But it's a dog," said Max. Max and Maddie Twist's parents were once famous, international detectives, before the evil Professor Sardine ruined their careers, that is. Now they run an ice cream parlour, and it is the super sleuth services of their crime-busting Cluedo champion children that are called upon. Mr. Hufendorf, a rich Swiss banker, is very worried about a series of bank raids that have been carried out by a team of highly trained St. Bernard dogs. Max and Maddie must pack their hats, scarves and various disguises, and fly to Switzerland to sniff out the criminal mastermind behind this cunning plot. More great titles by Alexander McCall Smith. The Bubblegum Tree. The Joke Machine. The Five Lost Aunts of Harriet Bean. The Popcorn Pirates. The Banana Machine. Harriet Bean and the League of Cheats. The Bursting Balloon Mystery. The Spaghetti Tangle. The Muscle Machine. The Cowgirl Aunt of Harriet Bean. Calculator Annie. The Donut Ring. Teacher Trouble. Chapter 1. Max and Maddie, Private Detectives. On the very edge of town in which Max and Maddie Twist lived, there was an ice cream parlour. It was not a large ice cream parlour. In fact, it was quite small, but it was very popular with people who liked really good ice cream in lots of different flavours. There were 37, to be exact. Behind the parlour there was a house, and this is where Max and Maddie lived with their parents. Mr. and Mrs. Twist had not been making ice cream for long. They used to be private detectives and had been the owners of the best private detective agency in the country. They had even won prizes for their detective work, the Best Disguise Award, which they won 2 years running, and the Most Difficult Clue Solved Award. Then, quite without warning, something terrible happened, and they had been forced out of business. What happened was not their fault, but was the work of an extremely cunning man called Professor Claude Sardine. This man had been wicked since birth. When he was a baby, he had hidden other babies' rattles and made them cry. Then, when he was a little bit older and was at school, he had cheated in the egg and spoon race, secretly sticking the egg to his spoon so that it would not fall off. A little later, he had soaked all the school chalk in water so that it would not write when the teacher tried to use it. And then, when he was much bigger, about 18, he had ruined the world's most famous cycle race, the Tour de France, by scattering drawing pins on the roads by night. That was a particularly mean and nasty thing to do. But then Professor Sardine was a very nasty man. Mr. and Mrs. Twist had once managed to thwart one of Professor Sardine's evil schemes, and he had never forgiven them for it. The professor had got hold of 2,000 pairs of underpants and had treated them all with itching powder. He was on the point of selling them at bargain prices to the public when Mr. and Mrs. Twist stepped in and put a stop to it. They had just been investigating the strange loss of 2,000 pairs of underpants from a knicker factory on the edge of town. The only lead they had was a sardine left at the scene of the crime. For a while, Mr. and Mrs. Twist were stumped, but not for long, because soon after that there was another burglary, this time at a joke factory. 2,000 bags of itching powder had been stolen, and once again the mysterious sardine left behind. But here the professor had made his fatal mistake. Little did he know that he was dealing with two real professionals. The Twists, with the sardines as evidence, questioned the town's fishmonger, deducing, quite rightly, that anyone dastardly enough to steal 2,000 pairs of underpants and 2,000 bags of itching powder would not be likely to pay honest money for a couple of sardines. And sure enough, the fishmonger was able to give a very good description of a man who had entered his shop, stolen the sardines, and run off, laughing in a chilling manner. An identical picture of the professor was soon drawn up by the Twists and pasted all over town with the words, "Do not buy underpants from this man," written underneath it. This spoiled Professor Sardine's fun, and he swore to drive the Twists out of business. His revenge had come in the shape of a simple but very wicked plan. He had gone to every newspaper in the country and paid for the publication of a large notice. This notice simply said that Mr. and Mrs. Twist, the famous detectives, had been arrested and sent to prison for 33 years and 3 months. Of course this was not true, but everybody believed it, and Mr. and Mrs. Twist's business was ruined. There was nothing for Mr. and Mrs. Twist to do but give up being detectives and open an ice cream parlour. Listening to their parents' stories, Max and Maddie soon found out a great deal about how to be a private detective. They also learnt a lot from the books which lined the walls of their parents' study. There was a very interesting book called 200 Simple Disguises. This book could itself be disguised. If you turned it upside down, it looked exactly like a cheese sandwich, and if you laid it on its side, it looked like an old hairbrush. But their favourite one of all was called How to Follow People Without Being Seen, Ever. This book had been written by Mr. and Mrs. Twist themselves, and there was a large photograph on the back cover just to prove it. In their spare time, when they were not reading books about private detection, the two children liked to play a game called Cluedo. This was tremendous fun, as it involved trying to find out who had committed a crime, just by asking questions and writing down the answers. Max and Maddie were soon so good at it that they won every time they played with other people. And when the local newspaper announced that there would be a grand Cluedo competition to find the champion player of the year, it was no surprise that Max and Maddie both entered. It was not all that easy. They found themselves up against very stiff competition, But at last, after a grand final filled with nail-biting suspense, the judges announced that the first prize had been won jointly by the two of them. Mr. and Mrs. Twist were extremely proud. "This proves it," crowed Mrs. Twist. "Detective talent runs in the blood. I've always said that." It was wonderful to have won the competition, but what happened next was even more exciting. Just a few days later, when the postman brought the mail, there was a letter for them with an unusual stamp on it. "Look," said their mother, handing Maddie the letter. "A letter from Switzerland. Do you know anybody there?" Maddie shook her head and started to open the letter. As she read it through, her jaw dropped with surprise. "What does it say?" asked Max in a very excited voice. "Read it out. It's addressed to me as well." Maddie read the letter, and now it was Max's turn to be astonished, for the letter from Switzerland was a very exciting one indeed. The person who wrote it, Mr. Conrad Hufendorf, a well-known and very rich Swiss banker, had read about their success in the Cluedo competition and asked them whether they could possibly solve a mystery for him. "If you can play Cluedo so well," he wrote, "then I am sure you will be able to solve a mystery for us here in Switzerland. I am a banker, as you may know, and I am very worried about what has been happening. There have been some very large bank robberies, and the police just cannot seem to solve the crime. Do you think you could help? After all, you're terribly good at Cluedo." Max and Maddie looked at their mother. "Do you think we could?" they asked. "Poor Mr. Hofendorf sounds terribly worried." Mrs. Twist thought for a moment. "Most parents would say no, of course, but then most parents don't run ice cream parlors with 37 flavors." So Mrs. Twist said, "Yes, of course you can go." She had been a private detective, you see, and she knew you could never turn down a real mystery, never. Suddenly, Maddie noticed a tiny P.S. to the letter, and she read it out carefully. This is what it said. "P.S. Of course, we will reward you handsomely for your help. We can either pay in money, we've still got a bit left, or, if you prefer, in bars of chocolate. Switzerland, as you know, makes the best chocolate in the world. So you just decide, money or chocolate, but not both." Which would you have chosen, I wonder? Really? Is that your answer? Well, well. And which do you think Max and Maddie chose? Read on, please. You'll find out later. Chapter 2. Wanted for Bank Robbery. "Welcome to Switzerland," said Mr. Hufendorf, taking off his hat and giving a small bow. Max and Maddie, fresh from their journey by plane and train, saw a small, rather round man standing in front of them. He was wearing a black coat with a velvet collar and tiny, pebble-like spectacles. He was very polite and insisted on carrying their suitcase for them. And when they were sitting in his car, which was waiting outside, he put a thick rug over their knees just to make sure that they were warm enough. As they sped along the streets on the way to Mr. Hufendorf's house, they saw snow everywhere, on the roofs of the houses, on the branches of the trees, and even on people's hats. And behind the town, climbing up towards the sky, there were mountains, and these too were covered with snow, rather like white icing on a cake. Mr. Hufendorf said nothing for a while, but then he suddenly turned to Max and asked him a question. "Where do you keep your money?" he inquired, peering at Max through his tiny round spectacles. I don't have very much," said Max, thinking of how he had spent his savings, every last coin of them, on two large bars of chocolate to eat on the journey. "But you must get pocket money," said Mr. Hufendorf. "Where do you put that?" "In my pocket, I suppose," answered Max. "Or, if I decide to save it up, I put it in my pencil case, or maybe in the drawer where I keep my socks." Mr. Hofendorf shook his head sadly. "Oh, dear," he said. "Oh, dear, oh, dear. The best place for pocket money is in a Swiss bank. Everybody knows that. Now, if you give me your pocket money, I would put it in my bank, and then it would be as safe as can be, all tucked away in the Hofendorf bank." Max thought for a moment. "But what about all the bank robberies?" he asked. "No robber would think to look in my sock drawer." Mr. Hofendorf suddenly looked taken aback.
"I suppose I'd forgotten about that," he said sadly. "You're quite right. Swiss banks aren't as safe as they used to be, I'm sorry to say. And all because of these dreadful robberies."
The banker paused and looked at the children.
"I have a photograph of one of the robbers, you know. Would you like to see it?"
"Well," said Maddie, "if we're going to help you find the robbers, I think we should know what they look like." Mr. Hofendorf fished into the inner pocket of his jacket and took out a small folded poster. On the top, printed in very large letters, it said, "Wanted for bank robbery." "Here," he said, "this is one of them. It was taken by a secret camera in the bank at the very moment of the robbery."
He handed the poster over to the children, who studied it carefully. Then they looked at one another in puzzlement.
"But it's a dog," said Max. "You said it was a photograph of a bank robber."
Mr. Hofendorf smiled.
"Exactly," he said. "It's a photograph of one of our famous Swiss mountain dogs, a St. Bernard. They are usually used to rescue people who have got lost in the snow. They have wonderful noses, you see, but now, I'm ashamed to say, they seem to have taken a bank robbery. Every single one of these robberies has been carried out by a dog."
As the car made its way along the winding mountain roads that led to Mr. Hofendorf's house, the two children listened in astonishment to the story of the extraordinary robberies.
"The first time it happened," said Mr. Hofendorf, "people could hardly believe it. The dog came into the bank, jumped over the counter, and immediately started to collect piles of banknotes in its mouth. St. Bernards have very large mouths, you know, and he managed to fit an awful lot in. Then he gave a growl. He couldn't bark because his mouth was full up, and he ran out of the door. Everybody was too astonished to give chase, and it was all over in 10 minutes.
That was the first bank robbery. Mr. Hofendorf went on to explain that the next one, which took place a few weeks later, was much the same, although this time it was a different dog. At this bank, the dog slipped in unseen and then managed to run up to the manager's desk and start growling at him in a most unfriendly way. By growling and barking, it had pushed the manager back towards the safe, and it had threatened to bite him until he opened the safe door. Then the dog had shot inside, grabbed a large bag of gold coins in its jaws, and dashed out again. Several more banks had been robbed in exactly the same way, and the dogs, which were different ones on each occasion, had got away with it every time. Somebody had tried once to give chase, but the dog had been too cunning. It is easy for a dog to get away from a human being, as they can squeeze through spaces which humans cannot get through. It's not all that easy for a person to crawl under a car and emerge the other side in no more than a second or two. Nor are people very good at wiggling through smelly stormwater pipes full of mud and old leaves. But dogs love that, so it was easy for them to get away. When Mr. Hofendorf had finished telling his story, he looked hopefully at Max and Maddie.
"Please do something about this," he said. "We really need your help."
Later that day, while Mr. Hofendorf went off to attend to some business, the two children stood in front of the great window of his sitting room, looking out at the snow-covered valley below.
"This is a very strange story," said Max. "I've never heard of anything like it. Dogs who rob banks?"
"I can't see how we can help," said Maddie. "If the police can't find these dogs, then are we going to do any better?" Max was silent.
He was staring out of the window, and Maddie knew when he did that he was thinking very hard.
"I've got an idea," he said after a while. "I think I know what to do. Tell me, Maddie, why do you think these dogs are robbing banks?"
Maddie scratched her head. "Because they're bad?" she suggested. "Because they're bad dogs?"
Max shook his head.
"No," he said. "Bad dogs chase cars and cats. They don't rob banks. The only reason why a dog would rob a bank is because it's been taught to do it. Somebody has trained these dogs to do their dirty work. Somebody has decided that the safest way of stealing money from the bank is to get your dog to do it. As long as the dog can slip away, you're never going to get caught. Nobody will see you. Nobody will know who you are. You just wait around the corner, take the money from the dog's mouth, and then you bundle the dog into a van and off you go."
Maddie thought for a moment. It sounded very strange, but it must be true. So what were they going to do about it?
Max looked at his sister and smiled.
"I've got a plan," he said. "I'll tell you about it a bit later. The first thing we have to do is to get a St. Bernard dog for ourselves. Then the next thing to do is to put an advertisement in the newspaper."
Maddie felt very puzzled, but she knew that her brother's plans were usually very good ones, and she was sure that this would be a good one too. But what could he possibly want with a St. Bernard dog? She was soon to find out.
Chapter 3. St. Bernard Dog Seeks Home.
"A St. Bernard dog?" exclaimed Mr. Hufendorf. "You want me to get you a St. Bernard dog?"
"Yes, please," said Max, "and we'd like a very obedient one, if possible."
Mr. Hufendorf scratched his head.
"Well, I suppose I can do that," he said. "I think my brother knows a man who has a cousin whose friend's aunt breeds these dogs. Should I ask him to ask him to ask her to ask him to ask her?"
It was agreed that Mr. Hufendorf should try as soon as possible to borrow the dog and bring it to the house. He went off to do this, while Max and Maddie went out to the garden, which was deep in snow, to throw snowballs and build a large snow dog. A few hours later, they saw Mr. Hufendorf's car winding back up the road to the house. The driver was in the front, and in the back seat sat Mr. Hufendorf and the largest dog the children had ever seen. The car stopped outside the front door, and Mr. Hufendorf got out, followed by the dog. The dog looked around, sniffed at the air, and gave an enthusiastic bark. Then it followed Mr. Hufendorf into the house to be introduced to Max and Maddie.
"This is Rudolf," said Mr. Hufendorf, and as he spoke, the dog held out a paw to be shaken.
It was a splendid dog, and like all Swiss dogs, it was extremely obedient and well-mannered. It sat politely on the floor and stood up when asked. When you called out, "Come here," it trotted over to sit at your side. And when you said, "Lie down," it lay down exactly where it was standing at the time with no questions asked. After they had spent a while getting to know Rudolf, Mr. Hufendorf asked Max to explain his plan.
"It's quite simple," said Max. "One of the best rules of being a good private detective is this. It's much easier to get the crooks to come to you than you to go to them. So, if we put an advertisement in the newspaper saying that the best trained St. Bernard dog in Switzerland is looking for a home, that might just be very interesting to the bank robbers. After all, their robberies are going so well that they'll be needing more dogs to help them."
Mr. Hufendorf looked doubtful.
"Perhaps," he said, and then, "Well, we can at least try. But do remember that we have to give Rudolf back. His owner is very fond of him. He won't come to any harm, will he?"
"I hope not," said Max.
At this, Rudolf gave a loud bark, as if he had understood everything that had been said. He was clearly a very intelligent dog, and it was just possible that he had picked up some of the plan. Dogs, after all, understand much more than they would like us to believe. And Rudolf perhaps had heard and taken in the word robbers.
"Yes," he thought, "robbers. You've picked just the right dog to help you. Oh, yes. Grrr. Just let me at him.
The advertisement appeared in the newspaper the next day. Excellent St. Bernard dog seeks home. Rudolph, our beloved St. Bernard, is a hard-working dog who is also very obedient. But St. Bernards are very big, and we are moving to a very small house. So could some kind person please look after him? There were one or two telephone calls that morning. One of them was from a lady who wanted Rudolph to pull a dog cart for her. Another was from a man who wanted him to scare cats out of his garden. Neither of these sounded like a bank robber, though, and Mr. Hufendorf thanked them politely and said that he would have to think about it. Then the doorbell rang, and this time it was a rather suspicious-looking man.
"Where's the dog?" he said rudely. "I'd like to see him."
Mr. Hufendorf invited him in, while Max and Maddie went to fetch Rudolph.
"Rather a scruffy-looking dog," said the man with a sneer. "I've seen much better."
Max shot Maddie a glance. As detectives, they could tell that this was the man. When you looked at him, his eyes slid away and his nose twitched ever so slightly. That was always a sign. "He's a very obedient dog," said Maddie. "Look, if I tell him to lie down, he'll do so immediately." The man watched as Rudolph went through his paces.
"I suppose I can take him,"
he said at the end of it all.
"Over here, dog. You're coming with me."
Rudolph seemed unwilling to go off with his new owner, but with a little encouragement from Max, he eventually allowed the man to fit a lead onto his collar and drag him out of the door. The man walked down the road with a rather miserable-looking Rudolph walking beside him, glancing backwards from time to time to see if his new friends were coming with him. They were, of course, but they remembered everything they had read in their parents' book, how to follow people without being seen, ever. And Rudolph would never have noticed them. When he looked behind him, as he did from time to time, did he think that there was something odd about that bush on the edge of the road? The one with the branches that seemed to be moving ever so slightly? Of course he did not. And when he saw that very tall person with a long coat and a hat pulled right down over his eyes, did he think that it was really a girl perched on a boy's shoulders? Not for a moment. There was a small station at the end of the road, and it is here that the man went, pulling Rudolph behind him. Max and Maddie waited, crouching behind a snowdrift at the edge of the railway line. When the train came, they would be able to slip into one of the carriages without being seen by the man or Rudolph. "I hope we don't lose Rudolph," whispered Maddie. "We've promised to bring him back." "Don't worry," said Max. "We won't lose him." When the train came, the two children were ready. While the man mounted the steps with Rudolph, they quickly shot into the next carriage and were safely seated by the time the engine driver blew his whistle. Then they were off, with the little Swiss train pulling bravely up the line as it wound its way further into the mountains. At the first stop, they watched carefully out of their window to see if the man got off. He did not, nor did he get off at the next stop. But at the one after that, they saw the carriage door open and the man stepped out, closely followed by Rudolph. Max and Maddie slipped off the train and took shelter behind a newspaper stand. Then, making sure to keep their distance, they followed the man down the street, sidling into doorways whenever it looked as if he might stop or turn round. The cable car left from the end of the village. Supported on towering metal posts, the cable ran up the side of the mountain to disappear into the clouds. It was mainly for skiers, but it was also very useful for people who lived in the houses which dotted the higher slopes. Max and Maddie watched as the man put Rudolph into a cable car and then climbed in himself. They waited for a while until they were quite sure they would not be seen. Then they quickly bought a ticket and took the next car that came along. Max did not like heights. They made him feel dizzy, so he closed his eyes as the car swung away from the cable station. Maddie was fine. She liked looking down at the tops of the pine trees beneath them and at the great banks of snow. Oh, look, she shouted. Skiers down below.
I can't look, said Max miserably. Oh, Maddie, when are we going to get there?
Maddie looked ahead. There was still a long way to go, and the ground was even further away below them.
Quite a long way, she said, thinking, I wonder what would happen if the cable broke. Would the snow break our fall?
Max was thinking exactly the same thing, and the thought made him turn a little bit green. He was also thinking about how they would have to come down again, which would probably be even worse.
Oh, if only we hadn't come to Switzerland in the first place, he said under his breath. If only we'd gone somewhere flat with no mountains like Holland or Texas or somewhere like that.
Chapter 4. A Familiar Face. At long last they reached the top of the cable. Maddie pushed back the door and Max opened his eyes slowly just to make sure they were no longer halfway up the mountain. There was no sign of the man at first, but after a few moments they saw him walking off in the direction of a group of trees in the snow. Rudolph was plodding along beside him. Like all St. Bernard dogs, he felt quite at home in the snow and had large padded feet to stop him from sinking in. They waited until the man was out of sight before they set off. It was easy to find his tracks in the snow and to follow him through the wood and into a ravine that ran down the mountainside.
There it is, said Maddie, pointing to a small group of buildings in the distance. That's where he's going.
Max looked in the direction in which his sister was pointing. It seemed to be a small farm with a house, a barn, and one or two sheds all perched on the mountainside.
We'll have to be careful, said Max. If we climb up a bit, we could get into those trees just behind the house and have a look at the place from there.
Maddie thought this was a good idea, and they quickly made their way across the mountainside to the shelter of the trees. Then, creeping forward in the snow, they peered down at the buildings beneath them. And at that exact moment, two things happened, one after the other, which made them realize that they had been right all along. The first thing was that there was suddenly a loud barking from one of the sheds. This was interesting, as it was not just one dog that was barking, but four or five, and they were all deep barks, exactly like the barks made by a St. Bernard dog. But the second thing was even more important. As the dog started to bark, a man came out of the back door of the farmhouse. It was not the man who had brought Rudolph, but somebody quite different. He was looking down at the ground first, but then he suddenly looked up, and for a moment Max and Maddie got a good view of his face. It was not a face they had ever seen before, in the flesh at least, but it was still a face they knew very well from a photograph which their father had showed them. It was none other than Professor Claude Sardine. The children stayed absolutely still, hardly daring to breathe in case the white clouds of their breath would give them away. But Professor Sardine had not seen them, and he went over to the shed where the dogs were barking. He opened the door, and five dogs rushed out, cavorting in the snow, all eager for some exercise. Professor Sardine reached down to pat one of them, and then apparently changed his mind and gave it a sharp kick.
"Did you see that?" whispered Maddie indignantly.
"Typical of him," her brother replied under his breath. "That's just the sort of man he is."
The two detectives watched while Professor Sardine exercised the dogs. He did this in a very unkind way. He tied a large bone to a string, and then he threw the bone into the snow. The dogs raced after it, hoping to have a chew on the delicious morsel, but it was always snatched away from them before they reached it. Then Professor Sardine would throw it in the opposite direction and laugh cruelly when the poor dogs were tripped again. After a while, though, he tired of all this and he shut the dogs back in the shed. Then he returned to the farmhouse, slamming the door behind him.
"So, it's Professor Sardine who's behind the robberies," said Max quietly. "We might have known." Yes, agreed Maddie, and this is such a good place for his headquarters, high up on the mountain where there's nobody to get suspicious.
Max thought for a moment.
We could go right back and tell Mr. Hufendorf, he said, or we could try to sort things out ourselves.
Maddie shivered, not from cold, but from fear. Max always wanted to sort things out himself, and sometimes she thought it was a little bit safer to let other people do that.
What could we do? She asked.
Max smiled.
A plan was forming in his mind, and it seemed to him that it would be rather good fun, as long as it went well. If it didn't go well, though, perhaps it was best not to think about that.
Let's try to find the money, he said. Then we'll free the dogs and take them with us. In that way, we'll rescue the dogs, get Mr. Hufendorf's money back for him, and stop Professor Sardine right in his tracks.
Maddie's mouth dropped open.
It sounded so simple the way Max had put it, but surely it would be terribly dangerous. What if they were caught? What would Professor Sardine do with them? It was bound to be something awful. Perhaps he'd push them down a glacier or something like that.
Max, though, seemed to have his mind made up.
Now listen, Maddie, he whispered. Here's the plan.
She listened with her heart in her mouth.
It was very dangerous indeed, and she was convinced that it would fail.
Max's plan was simple, or so he thought. He would creep down to the farmhouse and make his way to the side. There was a pile of firewood there, and he would crouch behind it. In the meantime, Maddie would very quietly make her way down to the back of the dog shed. Then, on a signal from Max, a quick whistle, she would start to scratch at the wooden wall of the dog shed while hiding behind it. This would disturb the dogs, who would bark. Professor Sardine, or his assistant, would then come out of the back door to see what was disturbing the dogs. Of course, Maddie would then stop scratching the wood and the dogs would no longer bark, but by that time, the back door of the house would be open and Max could dash into the farmhouse without being seen.
And then, said Maddie, what then?
Once I'm in the house, I have a good look round, he said. If I find the money, which I'm sure I will, I'll get it out somehow. Then we'll release the dogs and get back to the cable station as quickly as we can. That's all.
Maddie stared at her brother.
Had he gone quite mad? Boys sometimes did. Did he really think that such an elaborate scheme would work?
With a sinking heart, she realized that he did. And she knew that once her brother had decided on a plan, nothing would shift him. So she nodded and said that she would try.
Good, whispered Max, patting her on the back. Best of luck. Here goes.
Chapter 5. The Trapdoor.
Maddie waited until Max was hidden behind the woodpile. Then she drew a deep breath and dashed as fast as she could to the back of the dog shed.
So far, so good, she thought.
Now all she had to do was to wait for Max's signal. This came a minute or so later. A low whistle, which anybody else would think was a bird call, but which she knew was her brother. At this, Maddie took out the twig she had tucked into her pocket and began to scratch at the back of the shed. For a dog, it was an interesting noise, and it meant only one thing. Rats. Immediately Maddie started, the dogs began to whine and bark, and the more she scratched, the harder the dogs barked.
Oh, what a rat it must be, thought the St. Bernards. Oh, quick, let's at it. We'll teach it a thing or two.
Exactly as Max had hoped, the back door was flung open, and Professor Sardine strode out.
Why are you making that noise? He yelled angrily. You wretched dogs! I'll teach you to disturb my afternoon nap!
The irate professor strode to the dog shed to bang loudly on their door. He and his assistant had spent the entire night out planning the next robbery, and they were now terribly tired. The one thing he wanted to do was to sleep, so he would be wide awake for the wicked schemes they had planned for that night.
As the professor reached the shed, Max rose to his feet, checked that the coast was clear, and ran around the side of the house. The back door was still open, and he shot in, while Professor Sardine was still threatening and shouting at the dogs. Inside, Max found himself in a kitchen, with a large wood-burning stove, a table, and onions and hams hanging from the roof beams. He did not stay there, though, but quickly opened a door into a corridor. Several doors led off this, and Max took the first, hoping that he would discover nobody in the room behind it. But he was wrong. There was somebody in the room. It was the man who had come for Rudolph, and he was lying on a bed in one corner, fast asleep. Max caught his breath and closed the door silently behind him. If you have ever been in a room with a sleeping person whom you don't want to wake, you'll know what it's like. People are never quite still when they're asleep. They snuffle and move their toes. And at any moment, you think the slightest movement from you will wake them up. Max looked about him. There was another bed in the room with a crumpled cover, but not much else. There was a cupboard, a small chest of drawers, and a table on which some papers lay scattered. Max crept over to the table and picked up one of the papers. There were columns of figures which had been added up and ticked with a pencil. It was as if somebody had been adding up sums of money. Sums of money! Max's heart gave a leap. If somebody had been adding up money, then the money could be hidden here, right in this room. Very quietly, he moved over towards the cupboard and opened the door. There was nothing. Perhaps, like Max, the robbers had had the idea of hiding the money with their socks. He tiptoed quickly over to the chest of drawers and slid open the top drawer. It was full of socks and handkerchiefs, but no money. He looked in the second drawer, and that was full of shirts. The third drawer was empty. Max felt very disappointed. He would have to search the rest of the house now, and that would take time. It would also be dangerous, as at any moment he could bump into Professor Sardine. Yet he would have to do it. There was a noise outside, making Max start. Professor Sardine was back in the house, Max thought for a moment, his glance falling on the crumpled cover of a bed. With a sudden feeling of shock, he realized that the reason why the bed cover was crumpled was that somebody had been resting on the bed, and that person could only be Professor Sardine himself. Max would have to hide before Professor Sardine came back. He thought of the cupboard, but he was worried that the door might not stay closed, so that left only one place, under Professor Sardine's bed. Professor Sardine came back into the room, muttering to himself. "Those dogs," he said, "they bark and bark for no reason. I'll have to get a whip. That'll teach them." He sat down on the bed, took off his shoes, and flung them down on the floor. Although he was making quite a bit of noise, the man on the other bed slept on soundly. "Humph," snorted Professor Sardine. "It's all very well for you. I'm the one who has to do all the thinking round here. I'm the one who needs the sleep." Underneath Professor Sardine's bed, Max felt the mattress sag down towards him as the professor slumped down. Fortunately, there was still enough room, though, and Max was able to move his arms and legs. He turned slightly in order to be more comfortable. It was then that he saw it. There was a trapdoor directly under the bed. If this was the room they counted the money in, thought Max, then where better to keep the money itself? With a sudden sense of excitement, Max realized that he was probably lying directly above large amounts of money, and that all he would have to do would be to wait for Professor Sardine to go to sleep, and then he could prise open the trapdoor and see what lay beneath. He was sure it would be money. Lots of money. Lots and lots of money. Professor Sardine tossed and turned on the bed above Max's head. Then at last he was still, and Max heard a regular snoring sound come from above him. This was his chance, and as carefully as he could, he began to open the trapdoor, trying to avoid making the slightest sound. It was a difficult task, but at last the trapdoor lay open, and Max was able to peer down into the space below. For a few moments he could see nothing in the dark, and then he slowly began to make it out. He'd been right, exactly right. Immediately below him was a large open box with rope handles at each end. And inside the box, neatly stacked, were piles of banknotes. He'd found Mr. Hufendorf's money. Being as quiet as he possibly could, Max reached down through the trapdoor and took hold of the crate's handles. Max did his very best, but even so, from time to time, he bumped a shoulder or an elbow against the sagging mattress directly above him, and at one point even made Professor Sardine stir. After a few minutes of trying, he realized that it was simply not possible to get the crate out without moving the bed. Max sighed. He was so close to rescuing the money, but now he would simply have to give up or... He stopped. He had just seen that the bed, like many old-fashioned beds, had little wheels to make it easier to move round the room. Max wiggled out from under the bed and very gently took hold of the headboard. Then he pushed it lightly, just to see. And the bed moved. Slowly he began to push it across the floor, away from the trapdoor. Professor Sardine slept on, quite unaware of what was happening.
"He'll get a surprise when he wakes up," thought Max.
Max turned round to look at the trapdoor, and in that instant he let go of the headboard. If the bedroom floor had been normal, then there would have been no problem. But the floor was not normal. It sloped rather badly, and before Max could do anything about it, the bed began to move on its own. His heart in his mouth, Max ran after the bed, which had now crossed most of the bedroom floor. For a moment or two, he thought it would collide with the door, but it did not, and instead shot through the corridor. From there it gathered speed, pursued by Max, until it slid smoothly and gently into a large cupboard and came to a halt. Max crept up to the bed and peered at Professor Sardine. His peculiar journey had not woken him, and he was still fast asleep. Max tiptoed out of the cupboard and closed the door behind him. There was a key in the lock, and with a smile, he locked the door behind him. That was Professor Sardine taken care of. The professor would probably be able to break the cupboard door open or shout for his assistant to free him, but that would take a bit of time. Now came the difficult part. The crate was far too heavy for one person to lift, and Max had no choice but to drag it. This was difficult to do without making a noise, and Max was sure that at any moment he would wake the sleeping assistant. But somehow he did not. And he found himself dragging the crate along the corridor and into the kitchen. From there it was easy to open the back door and push the heavy crate down the steps and onto the snow. Maddie had been watching. When she saw the back door open, her heart stood still. Oh, but she breathed a sigh of relief when she saw that it was her brother with a large crate. Was that the money? She wondered. It must be. Max straightened up and looked towards their hiding place. Putting his fingers to his mouth, he whistled and beckoned to Maddie to come down. "You've done it," Maddie said softly as she reached his side and looked down into the open crate. "You've found the money." Max nodded. "Yes," he whispered. "It's all in this crate, but it's very heavy. I can't carry it by myself. You'll have to help me once we've let the dogs out." They left the crate where it stood and ran over to the dog shed. The dogs had heard something, and when Max and Maddie opened the door, the great animals were all over them, licking their faces with affection and wagging their heavy furry tails. Rudolph was particularly pleased to see them, and he insisted on covering Maddie's face with great wet dog-like kisses before she managed to push him off and calm him down a bit. One of the other dogs opened his mouth as if he was going to bark, but Rudolph, sensing that it was important for them all to keep quiet, glared at him and growled. That stopped the bark before it even left the dog's throat.
"This way," said Max, calling Rudolph to his side. "Follow me and tell the other dogs to come too."
Rudolph understood perfectly. He gave a growl and a grunt to the other dogs, and they all fell into line behind him. Then Max and Maddie, with the 5 St. Bernard dogs in an obedient line behind them, ran back to the crate. Together, Max and Maddie picked it up, one person holding each end, and began to make their way as fast as they could through the snow towards the cable station. It was a long walk, and a hard one too, as much of it was uphill. As they went along, the crate seemed to get heavier and heavier, and Max and Maddie had to stop more and more often to rest and regain their strength. But they made progress, and soon they had crossed the ravine and were able to look back at the farm buildings, now far down below them in the brilliant white snow fields.
"Look how far we've come," said Max. "Now all we have to do is..."
He stopped. As they looked down towards the farm, they saw the back door burst open and 2 tiny figures run out. They saw one of the figures spin round and look up towards them, pointing in their direction.
"He got out of the cupboard," Max said. "He'll be furious."
"Cupboard?" asked Maddie. "Who was in what cupboard?"
"Professor Sardine," said Max. "You see, there were wheels on his bed and the floor sloped and there was an open cupboard..." He stopped. "I'll tell you about it later on. I think they've seen us."
Chapter 6 Cable Car Adventure. Max and Maddie lost no time. Picking up the crate, they plunged ahead, almost falling over one another in their haste. The snow was deep, and their feet sank down with each step. But they realized that if they did not hurry, they would soon be caught by the professor and his assistant. They had snowshoes and could make much quicker progress than the children who were wearing ordinary snow boots. The dogs realized that something was wrong, and they barked encouragement to the children and defiance towards their pursuers. But it did not do a great deal of good, as the next time they looked behind them, they saw they were losing ground quickly.
"They'll catch us in no time," moaned Max. "They're much faster than we are."
Now it was Maddie's turn to have a good idea.
"Look," she said, "it's now mostly downhill from here to the cable station. If we had a toboggan, we could go much faster."
"That's not much use," panted Max.
"We haven't got a toboggan. You might as well say if we had an aeroplane."
He stopped. He saw what Maddie meant now, and it was a wonderful idea.
"The crate," he exclaimed. "Why don't we use it as a toboggan?"
"That's just what I thought," said Maddie. "Now, we must hurry. They're getting closer and closer all the time." They put down the crate and pointed it in the direction of the cable station. Then, with Maddie getting in the front and Max sitting immediately behind her, both of them perched on top of piles of money, they gave the crate a good push with their arms. It was slow at first, but after a moment or two, it started to slide more quickly. Then, as the ground began to slope more sharply, the crate really picked up speed, and soon it was rushing along the ground like a bobsleigh in a mountain race. The dogs thought this was tremendous fun, and they galloped along beside the crate, the fresh white powder flying off their feet in tiny snow showers. When the pursuers saw the children shooting off in their makeshift toboggan, they shouted out in fury and broke into a run. It's not easy to run in snow. In fact, it's impossible, as the 2 men were soon to find out. Down went Professor Sardine, flat on his face in the snow. His assistant reached down to pick him up, and then he slipped and landed on top of him. Professor Sardine now struggled to his feet and reached down to pull his assistant up. But the assistant tugged hard on his hand and then suddenly let go, which made Professor Sardine fall over backwards and slide away on the snow.
"You idiot!" yelled Professor Sardine at his assistant. "They're getting away! Quick, after them!"
Of course, in their makeshift toboggan, the 2 children reached the cable station well before the 2 men chasing them. They drew to a halt just as an empty cable car reached the top, and without wasting any time, they bundled the dogs inside and then dragged their toboggan crate in behind them. The cable car began its journey down just as the professor and his assistant reached the top of the hill above the cable station. The professor shouted out and shook his fist, but the children just laughed. There was nothing he could do to them now. Once they reached the bottom, they would immediately telephone Mr. Hufendorf and tell him to come and collect his money. He would telephone the police, and before too long, Professor Sardine and his evil assistant would be safely locked up in jail. Or so the children thought. They had not reckoned on the fact that they were dealing with one of the most cunning and determined villains in the world, and he still had one or two tricks up his sleeve. In fact, although the children did not realize it, they were just about to find themselves faced with the greatest danger they had ever encountered in their lives. Halfway down the mountainside, while Max was sitting with his eyes firmly closed so that he could not see the drop, and while Maddie was talking soothingly to the rather frightened St. Bernard dogs, the cable car suddenly stopped.
"Have we arrived at the bottom?" asked Max, not daring to open his eyes. "That seemed rather quick."
Maddie looked down. They were nowhere near the bottom, and in fact they were quite a way above the top of a tall pine tree.
"I'm afraid we haven't," she said. "The cable car has just stopped. There's something wrong."
Max gave a groan as he realized what had happened. Professor Sardine must have done something to stop the cable, and now he had them at his mercy. All he would have to do was to get a high ladder and climb up to catch them. There would be nothing they could do. Max was right. Up at the cable station, Professor Sardine and his desperate assistant had overpowered and tied up the man in charge of the controls. Then they had pulled the lever which stopped the great engine that wound up the cable. Now, all they had to do was to fetch the ladders which the cable car crew used to fix the cable, drag them down the hill, and climb up to where the children were trapped. It was all perfectly simple, although they hadn't decided exactly what they would do with the children when they caught them. Still, there would be plenty of time to think of that. Maddie saw them coming and grabbed her brother's arm. "Look," she said, "I know you feel dizzy up here, but look over there." Max looked up at the mountainside above them. There were two figures carrying a very long ladder, struggling down through the snow towards them. Max gave another groan. "Oh, it's all over," he said. "We're trapped." Maddie shook her head. "No," she said, "don't give up yet. Here, give me your scarf." Max unwound the long scarf which Mr. Hufendorf had lent him, while Maddie did the same with hers. Then, knotting them together at one end, Maddie began to dangle the scarf out of the open window of the cable car. When it was hanging out as far as it would go, she tied the end of the newly made scarf rope to the handle of the door. Next, sticking her head out of the window, Maddie looked down. The scarf was blowing a bit in the wind, but she could see that it just reached the top of the tree below them. That was just what she'd hoped for, and she gave a great sigh of relief. "Oh, we're going to be all right, Max," she said calmly. "All you have to do now is climb down the scarf and grab hold of the top of the branches of the pine tree, then let go of the scarf." Max gulped. "And then?" he said. "Pine trees are very thin and bendy," said Maddie calmly. "The tree will bend down like a spring and lower you gently to the ground. That's how it should work," she paused. Should I go first?" Max nodded. "Please," he said. I promise I'll come after you. I promise." Maddie now turned to the crate and took off her jersey. Slipping the jersey over it, she tied the arms firmly, making a very secure bag. "This will stop the money falling out," she said. "Now all we have to do is to throw it down into the snow." Together, they pushed the crate to the open door of the cable car and gave it a shove. Down it went, turning over and over as it fell, until it reached the snow and dropped in with a satisfying plop. Now it was Maddie's turn, and she bravely let herself down on the scarf until she was in a position to grab for the tree. Once she had done that, the cable car gave a lurch as it was lightened, and Max's stomach seemed to turn upside down within him. For Maddie, it was an even worse feeling. As she grabbed the tree, she felt it give beneath her, and it seemed that she would plummet to the ground. But the branches held, and just before her feet touched the snow, her fall was broken. She let go of the tree just at the right time and found herself firmly on the ground exactly next to the spot where the crate had fallen. "Your turn now, Max," she called up at the swaying cable car. "Hurry up!" Gingerly, Max let himself down the scarf, trying as hard as he could not to look below him. Then he too grabbed the tree, and down he went as the trunk bent under his weight. "Let go!" shouted Maddie as Max's feet neared the ground. "Let go now!" Max may have heard her, or he may not. Whatever the reason, he did not let go of the tree, and so the trunk bent back up again like a spring that has just been released. Then Max let go, but at entirely the wrong time. As he let go, it was as if Max had been shot from a giant catapult. Head over heels he went, the wind rushing through his hair, the ground getting further and further away beneath him. Then he started to drop, down and down like a stone, to disappear with a puff of white into a great snowbank. "Max!" shouted Maddie in despair. "Max, are you all right?" Up above in the cable car, Rudolph had seen all this. Now, deep inside him, his St. Bernard nature reminded him of his duty. This is exactly what St. Bernard dogs had been bred to do. Their task was to dig people from out of the snow, and a tiny voice inside Rudolph told him that his grandfather and his great-grandfather and even his great-great-grandfather were watching him, waiting for him to do what was expected of him. With a huge leap, Rudolph launched himself into space. Down he went, to be followed one after another by all the other St. Bernard dogs. To Maddie, standing below, her mouth wide open with astonishment, the dogs looked like a squadron of aeroplanes, their feet spread wide, their great ears blown behind them in the wind. The dogs fell down when they landed in the snow, but not one of them stayed down. Up they got, shook the snow from their coats, and rushed over to the place where Max had disappeared. Then, howling with excitement, they burrowed and dug, hurling the snow in every direction like snowplows gone wild. Poor Max! It was bad enough being buried in the snow, but to find himself suddenly being licked by five large pink tongues was almost too much. So he struggled out from the hole and ran back to where Maddie was waiting for him. "You're safe," she cried, giving her brother a welcoming hug. Max cast an anxious glance up the mountainside. "Yes," he said, "thanks to Rudolph and his friends. But we haven't got a moment to lose. The professor will be down here any time now. We've got to get going." Chapter 7. Chocolate Money. They began to drag the crate down the mountainside, but it was very difficult going, and they soon realized they would never manage to get away if they took it with them. "We'll have to leave it," said Maddie. "The important thing is for us to escape." Max thought for a moment. He looked at the dogs who were waiting patiently for their next order. Then he looked at Maddie and smiled. "We'll bury it," he said. "We'll get Rudolph and his team to dig a hole, and then they'll fill it in. Professor Sardine will think we've still got the crate, and he'll chase after us rather than look for the money." Maddie agreed that this was an excellent idea, and they quickly organized the dogs into digging a deep hole at the foot of a tree. Then, when the crate had been safely dropped into it, the dogs very quickly closed the hole again, leaving no traces at all. Maddie carefully marked a tiny cross on the tree with her penknife, so they'd know where to find it again. In the meantime, Professor Sardine and his assistant had been struggling down the hill towards them, and Max and Maddie had a nasty surprise when they looked up and saw the two men getting closer by the minute. The professor and his assistant had not seen the hole being dug, but the children knew that if they were caught, the professor would soon be able to force them to tell where the crate was hidden.
"We'll never get away," gasped Maddie. "They're far too close."
Max looked up at the two approaching figures. So did Rudolph. And he frowned, a great St. Bernard frown that knit his brows into 100 furrows. Then he growled, and at his growl, all the other dogs swung their heads around and looked in the direction of the two men.
Max and Maddie watched in amazement as the dogs formed themselves into a long line and began to bark fiercely.
"They're giving us the chance to get away," said Max. "Quick, let's go down the hill."
The sight of the snarling dogs stopped Professor Sardine in his tracks.
"Sit," he shouted out to the dogs. "Lie down."
This only made the dogs growl more fiercely, and one darted forward and gave the assistant a good nip on the leg. This was enough for the two men, who turned round and began to make off back up the hill, with Professor Sardine shouting over his shoulder, "You haven't seen the last of me! I'll get you for this!"
Rudolph realized that all was now well, and that Max and Maddie had been given a good start, but he could not resist the temptation of running after Professor Sardine and taking a large bite out of his snowsuit. This soon shut him up. The enraged professor gave a yelp and stumbled off as fast as he could with a large and very cold hole in the seat of his pants.
"We're going to make it," said Max as they saw the spire of the village church sticking out of the trees below them. Maddie gave a shout of joy. "Yes," she said. "I can smell the bakery from here. They're baking marzipan cakes. Can you smell it?"
Max could, and the smell meant safety. He reached out to Rudolph, who was running along beside him.
"Thank you, Rudolph," he said. "I think that you and your friends saved my life up there."
Rudolph gave a bark in reply. It had been a pleasure for him to do what he did. He knew that his grandfather, who had once saved two climbers trapped by an avalanche for 3 days, would be very proud of him, and that was enough reward for a dog. Down in the village, the local policeman listened to the children's breathless account of what had happened.
"I see," he said. "I've been a bit suspicious of what's been going on up there, but I had no idea that it was bank robbers we've been hearing about. Well done. You've certainly done a very good job."
While the policeman telephoned Mr. Hufendorf, the children were given a warm and reviving cup of piping hot chocolate, and each dog was given a large bowl of steaming milk. Half an hour later, Mr. Hufendorf arrived, together with some more senior policemen, wearing skis and carrying all sorts of ropes and ice axes. Mr. Hufendorf shook hands solemnly with the two children and listened in astonishment to their account of what had happened. Then they all set off up the hill to the marked tree where the money had been buried. And the policeman, assisted by Rudolph and his friends, dug the crate out from underneath the snow. In the meantime, some of the other policemen went off in search of Professor Sardine and his assistant. They combed the hillside and then went up to the farmhouse, but they found no sign of the wicked pair. It seemed as if both of them had just vanished into thin air. But they did find something. Up at the top, pinned to the trunk of a tree, just beyond the cable station, they found a hastily scribbled note.
"He's always like that," explained Max. "Nobody ever really catches him. They get close, but he always slips away."
"One day," said Mr. Hufendorf, "one day he will be caught, and I rather think it will be you two who will do the catching."
"Perhaps," said Max. "Who knows?"
Back at Professor Hufendorf's house, a large party had started. Mr. Hufendorf had telephoned all his banker friends to tell them the good news and invite them to come and thank Max and Maddie in person. The money had been counted and returned to the banks, and then a telephone call had been put through to Mr. and Mrs. Twist to tell them of the successful outcome of the case.
"I shall always be grateful to you," said Mr. Hufendorf. "Indeed, all Swiss banks will be grateful to you."
At this, all Mr. Hufendorf's banker friends clapped their hands and cheered. This was quite unusual for the Swiss, who are normally rather quiet, but it was a very special occasion after all. Max and Maddie left Switzerland the next day, but before they left, Mr. Hufendorf invited them into his study to discuss their payment.
"You'll remember that I said you could have it in money or chocolate," he said. "That offer still holds. Which would you prefer?"
Max turned to Maddie, and the two of them had a quick, whispered discussion. Then he turned back and announced their choice.
"Chocolate money," he said, "if that's all right with you."
Mr. Hufendorf clapped his hands with delight.
"Oh, what a clever choice," he said. "In that way you get both. I shall immediately arrange for it to be delivered to you at the station."
They said farewell, and they both gave Rudolph and the other dogs a very special hug.
"These dogs will all be returned to their owners," said Mr. Hufendorf. "All of them except Rudolph were the victims of kidnapping by those wicked men. Now their owners will get them back."
Mr. Hufendorf drove them to the station and said goodbye on the platform. Then the two children climbed into their carriage and settled down in their seats.
"Oh," said Maddie suddenly, "we forgot about the chocolate money."
Max smiled.
"Look up,"
he said. Maddie did. There, above their heads, neatly stacked on the luggage racks, were 10 large sacks, each of them stuffed full of delicious-looking chocolate coins.
"That'll keep us going for years," exclaimed Maddie. "What a generous present."
Max nodded.
"Perhaps we should try just one or two," he said. I promise not to eat too many before we get home."
Max really meant that promise. But there are some promises which are really just too hard to keep. I'm sure you understand what I mean, don't you?
Closing announcement. That concludes The Chocolate Money Mystery by Alexander McCall Smith, published in 2006 by Bloomsbury, London, narrated by Michelle Hine and produced by Helen Marney. This audio version, for the use of people with print disabilities, was produced in 2006 by the Royal New Zealand Foundation of the Blind, in accordance with Section 69 of the New Zealand Copyright Act, 1994. No unauthorised copying, broadcasting, or public performance is permitted.